Hi, I'm Luke Dennis, the Development Director at WYSO. We are happy we can deliver these programs to you, people who listen on the web, and we rely on you to help us pay for this service. So at our website, wyso.org, click Support This Station and help keep these services coming. And thank you.
Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I'd like to welcome to the program today Chris West. He joins us by telephone from somewhere, I believe, in Manhattan. Hello, Chris.
Hello, Vic.
Chris, you have a new book out. It's called A History of Britain in 36 Postage Stamps. I love this idea. How did you come up with this?
Well, it sort of grew very naturally out of my collecting stamps, which, again, is something I sort of didn't do for a long time in my life. And then I started doing it kind of, I don't know, in sort of middle age, really. And as I collected these stamps, I became fascinated by them as little rectangular time machines that take you back into history, which they're very good at. They do that because of the design, and they also, of course, were carrying letters, what was in the letters, what was life like for the people who wrote the letters inside them, what was Britain like at the time the letter was sent? All these sort of questions just emerged naturally from finding these objects and sticking them in an album.
I'm a bit of a philatelist myself, not a very active one these days. I kind of lost my taste for it after they went to the more modern type of stamps. I don't collect the self-adhesive ones or the ones that aren't engraved. It lost its appeal.
Yeah, they're not the same. I agree. And I think also there's been a kind of philatelic inflation of loads and loads of issues coming out, which in a sense makes it difficult to collect them all because there's just so many now. It's the same in Britain as well. I think the States is probably even more, but it's not that dissimilar.
Yeah. I'm guessing that a lot of these stamps that are pictured in your book are stamps that are in your collection?
Most of them, yes. There is one. No, they are all in the collection, actually. I was just going to say there's one that isn't, but no, they are all in the collection. The one of them is quite valuable, but I only have a rather tatty copy. But they are, otherwise, they're all in my collection, that's right.
Is that the Penny Black?
No, the Penny Black is, it's not, you know, it's obviously a very nice stamp to possess, but it's not ridiculously expensive. You can probably pick up one up for a couple of $100 or something. The 5-shilling red stamp, which is more expensive, from Queen Victoria's era.
1867, and that would have been on a big package to go overseas.
That's right, that's right.
Mm-hmm.
Crossing the Atlantic, no doubt, on a wonderful Brunel iron ship.
Oh, yes. Let's talk about the process here. You'd take a stamp, let's say the Penny Black, and would you look at it? Would you go into the history? What would you do? How would you decide what the theme was going to be for each particular one?
Well, I think it's something you just have to kind of do, really, and you just sort of pick up a stamp. And well, it sounds rather sort of weird, but it kind of speaks to you in a way. And some stamps, you look at them, just don't say anything. Others just seem to have something to say. The Penny Black is, in a way, an easy one because the story of the stamp itself is absolutely fascinating, because it all began with this amazing man, Rowland Hill, who was this fantastic social entrepreneur. This brilliant man. He understood that the postal system in his day was completely broken. It was expensive. It was inefficient. And he completely reinvented it and thought through how it worked, how he would meet objections to it, fought for it politically, and made it happen. Immensely impressive man. And so there's a great story in there. It's a great story, naturally, in that stamp. Another stamp, and the next one I talk about is the Shilling in Bust stamp. And that, I don't know, I just sort of, because it was the first stamp used to send mail from Britain to America, it made me think about how the letters would have got there, and they would have gone on these wonderful iron ships that Brunel built. So I kind of talk about them, and it's really just the stamps that they seem to sort of speak to me in a way. It sounds a bit strange, but that is how it works.
And the 1-shilling embossed came out in 1847, and if memory serves, I believe that's just about the year that they started making stamps in the United States.
It is indeed. It's exactly the year they started making stamps. The a Washington and a Ben Franklin came out in I think, June 1847. Was it July? I'm not sure, but it's only 1847 anyway.
Your next essay is about the penny red with Irish postmark in 1848, and this is the one that gives you an opportunity to talk about the terrible things that were going on in Ireland.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm British. I felt very ashamed writing that chapter because the appalling mismanagement of Ireland, which was in those days, it was part of Great Britain. That's why it has a penny red stamp. And why, again, the stamp was so expressive, because this was part of Britain. If you lived in London, wanted to send a letter to Dublin, or the other way around, you just stick one of those on, and it just went through the postal system. But Ireland was treated totally differently, and I was absolutely terrible. So that was a difficult chapter to write, but it had to be told, I think, the story.
Chris West joins us. His new book is A History of Britain in 36 Postage Stamps. You alluded to the 5-shilling red, 1867, earlier. That's the rarest one, of the ones pictured, right?
Yes. It's not stunningly rare, but the higher value stamps tend to be rarer because fewer were made. One of the amazing things about the Victorian stamps is how many were made of the lower denomination ones. Billions of stamps. And this is all from one man's bright idea. It's an exciting story.
And you show us all these stamp designs that you feature, and we see the profile of Queen Victoria on so many of the early ones. And just the whole design thing, you really tear this apart. You really look into it, the flaws, the good ideas behind some of the designs. Do you want to talk about that at all?
The designs speak of their times very much. You get a stamp like the Queen Victoria's Jubilee stamps, and they're wonderfully cluttered, colourful, lively stamps, which are just like the sort of cluttered Victorian. If you go into an old Victorian museum, see how cluttered people had their houses. The stamps are like that. Incidentally, the stamps of Queen Victoria's head on, she remains the same age from all the way through. They used the same imagery. Uh-huh. And she was an old widow in her 70s and 80s, they still had this young monarch's head on. It's a bit like a picture of Dorian Gray. She never aged. And then, of course, we go on through the 1920s. You've got the kind of very imperial, old-fashioned line engraved stamps. Then we get modernism comes in the 1930s. Then we sort of go back a little bit after the war because people wanted a bit of peace and quiet. And the kind of stamps are quite retro. And then we get very modern in the 60s. The history of design itself is a reflection on the history of the nation and how it sees itself. And it's shown very clearly in the nation's stamps.
When you talk about the 5-shilling red, that expensive stamp, which shows the affluence of a society that could mail packages around the world to all those British colonial possessions, you talk about something you call the wealth machine. And you mentioned this a number of times. What are you meaning by that?
Well, Britain did sort of crack this idea of a capitalist society. Capitalism sometimes gets a slightly bad name. And it's a society which is based on industrial production and which has competitive markets for goods and services. This is what Adam Smith talked about back in 1776, another rather significant date. It's basically that cranked into action in Victorian Britain, well before in Hanoverian Britain, but it really is stemming on from what Smith wrote about. They cracked the system for producing tremendous amounts of wealth. Of course, I mean, Smith himself believed that the system would spread wealth widely. And it sort of did in Victoria's day, but obviously not as much as one would like it to have done. You read Dickens and you read about the terrible poverty that some people lived in. If you look at the figures, by and large, people in Britain became better off in Victoria's reign pretty substantially, though clearly an underclass of people didn't.
And by World War II, this pretty much came grinding to a halt, didn't it, with the onset of the war and Britain being squeezed so tight. And then we had Lend-Lease, but then after the war, that went away, and suddenly indebtedness was a problem.
Yes, well, the indebtedness, and it happened after both wars. We racked up enormous debts to win the First World War, and then the same the Second World War. Britain was bankrupt by about 1941. If it hadn't been for you guys, we'd have, I don't know, we'd have gone under, basically. Financially, anyway, there was no money left. So Lend-Lease undoubtedly saved our bacon. After the war, the rug was removed, and it was a bit of a struggle. I love there's an Olympic stamp in there from 1948.
Uh-huh.
Because we had these wonderful austerity Olympics in London in 1948, which were really done on a complete shoestring. And they had, there was basically an old dog track was converted into the running track in Wembley, an ice rink. They melted the ice, and the Olympic swimming pool was there. And the velodrome at Herne Hill, they had the bicycle races, and in the evening, when it got dark, people turned their car headlights on, because they didn't have any floodlights, so that the bicycle racing could be illuminated. It was sort of, the whole thing was incredibly kind of, make it up on the spot. But it was great, and I think there was a tremendous sense of a nation fighting its way out of a difficult hole that comes across in the story of that Olympics, and a beautiful stamp, a beautiful Edward Dulac stamp to go with it.
And this was after the 44 games were canceled that were to be in London. And we look back to the games in 36 in Hitler's Germany, where it was just this grandiose production. He spent huge amounts of money. And then we have this austerity Olympics 8 years later. It's fascinating to read about that.
I think they did. Both Olympics ended up sending out a message. And I think the London Olympics sent out a message of hope, a message of friendship, and the world working together to solve its problems in a very attractive way. I think they were very marvelous alive then. I think they, reading about them, they seem to be a marvelous occasion.
As I mentioned before, I love stamps, and I love the Postal Service. I see the decline of the Postal Service in Great Britain and in the United States as almost a metaphor for the decline of our industrial societies in these countries.
Yeah, it is a worry. I don't know what the future is going to be for the Postal Service. I suppose I'm essentially an optimist, and I do see that, for example, parcels, what comes through the post has changed a lot. You don't get so many letters. You get a certain amount of junk mail that goes in the bin, but you do get a lot of parcels. Amazon, eBay, these big trading companies are using the post. And what I hope is that the post will grab this opportunity and sort of keep up to date, and will resurrect itself through the online trading that goes on.
Chris West joins us. His book is A History of Britain in 36 Postage Stamps. You do note that the Internet has had a major impact on first-class letters in the U.S. and in Great Britain, and that in Great Britain they really haven't made a whole lot of stamps celebrating computers.
No. I think there's a certain amount of sort of looking across at them, there's a certain amount of distaste, and these guys are putting us out of business. But I think that's the wrong attitude. I think the post office is waking up to that and realizing that they've got to work with computers, and the Internet can generate business for them as well as take it away. There have been some good stamps. I feature a stamp in the book, which is a lovely one by a lovely artist called Peter Till, which shows the World Wide Web being kind of knitted out of a computer. It's a neat little stamp.
Mm.
And there are some positive vibes around.
After the Second World War ended, they put out the Victory 2.5D commemorative stamp in 1946. This is also the period where Winston Churchill fell out of power, and Britain became, to use a term which is considered pejorative in many parts of the United States, more socialist. And here you're looking at the United States from afar. You've come into our country. You've probably been reading the newspapers the last few weeks about how our health care law has almost shut down the government, shut down all kinds of things, has had just quite an impact, a lot of debate about it. And in this essay, you note that, to quote, that the welfare state, scarcely imagined before World War II, has become an accepted part of British life, with political debate almost always centering around who can manage it better rather than whether it should exist. And that really struck a chord with me, looking at our own situation over here, because we seem to be debating whether it should exist rather than how to manage it better.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's very difficult. For me as an outsider coming in, I'm very loath to start telling you guys how to run your country. We stopped doing that in 1781, or whatever it was, the Battle of Yorktown. So I don't want to start now, but I think it worked well in Britain. It has its problems. It has its difficulties. I think the problems in the States are that a lot of money seems to go into healthcare spending. I mean, you actually spend more money on it than we do in Britain in terms of percentage of GDP.
Chris, I don't think that the British gave up in Yorktown. I seem to recall a little bit after that they burned down the White House, but we won't get into that.
Oh, well, yeah, that's a different war. Well,
My guest is Chris West. His book is A History of Britain in 36 Postage Stamps, just published by Picador. Tell us a little bit about yourself. I know you've written a lot of things. Who are you?
Well, I'm a professional writer. Some words in my business. I've been that way for a number of years, actually. I've written a series of crime novels set in China. I was actually the first person to do that, to write sort of whodunit-type crime fiction set in modern China. I did four of those, and they were published in the States, actually, and I used to come over to the crime conventions every year in the USA and talk about my books and things. I kind of felt I'd done that, really, after four books. I wrote some business books about entrepreneurship, about how to start and run small businesses, because I'd had a couple of friends of mine who were entrepreneurs, and I got really interested in what they were doing, and really liked what they were doing, and I sat down with one of them and we sort of put a book together. And that was very successful in Britain and done quite well around the world. Wrote some other books about other aspects of small business. But I've always been fascinated by history and wanted to write a book about history. And this sort of project just appeared, really. Just came along and just felt absolutely right. I'm now doing one about the USA.
Are you?
Yes.
With stamps?
Yes, same story.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
How wonderful. So you're picking out the stamps right now?
Yep, absolutely, as we speak.
Wow. I can't wait to see that.
It's been, I'm hugely enjoying writing it. It's a very different experience. I have to learn a lot. Most of what was in the British history book I sort of knew, and it was a question of just getting it into order and checking facts and thinking, well, do I really think that? And, you know, sometimes you can hold quite contradictory views about history if you don't think them through. And having to write a book about your essays at university, you sort of think, oh, well, that doesn't follow from that and all that. So I think the British history book was largely an exercise in sticking something together that I sort of had lots of bits of. With American history, I've really had to do a lot of research, talk to lots of people, and it's been absolutely fascinating. I've loved it.
So you've had to learn some things that were unfamiliar. I thought I knew quite a bit about British history, but I learned a lot from reading your book. For one thing, you make Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain look like he wasn't such a bad guy after all.
I don't think he was. I mean, again, this is very much open for debate. I don't think he was. I think he was a slightly weak man. So you can argue that all this stuff about peace in our time and things, he bought time. Because we had to rearm. I don't really talk about this in the book, but sort of now you've initiated the discussion. We needed time. Hitler was way ahead of us with his technology, his aeroplanes, all that sort of stuff. We had to catch up. And he bought us 6 months when we were furiously rearming. People don't really... Sort of, people think of Chamberlain as a sort of wet blanket, just let Hitler walk over him. But in the time that he prevaricated, he didn't, you know, we were building up our strength. Whether a short, sharp shot would have sort of stopped Hitler in his tracks, we said no, if he'd moved into Czechoslovakia, that's possibly the case. We don't know. We never will know. I mean, history's got, I mean, it's great fun, and every history lover loves playing it. What would have happened if, .. Hmm. Maybe if Churchill had been prime minister in those days, Hitler could have been stopped. The other thing about Chamberlain is, I mean, the nation wasn't really ready for war. We're still, you go to any English village and you'll see the war memorial. There are 10 names on it from the First World War.
Mm-hmm.
People, you know, everybody had lost someone in the First World War. They didn't want to go through that again if they didn't have to. I think it was undoubtedly the right thing to do, to go to war against Hitler, but it's understandable that it took time to turn opinion around. It's a bit like Roosevelt in the States. I mean, it took time to move public opinion.
I also appreciated your observations on some of the tactics, like your view that Hitler liked picking off one country at a time, and this might have cost him an opportunity to really take Britain, and also just the blunders that he made strategically. I mean, we all know that going into Russia was a big mistake now, but just your observations of the way that he handled this, and then that conference in, I believe it was in Iran, in Tehran, where Stalin and Roosevelt and Churchill all got together, and the terrible thing that Stalin said, and that Roosevelt, I had never heard that quote before that Roosevelt said to Stalin. I was appalled.
Yeah, that's Stalin said something like, we'll need to eliminate 50,000 German officers or something. I don't know what he won the war, and Roosevelt said, well, maybe 49,000 would do, or something like that. I think, I mean, it has to be taken in context. He was trying to sort of jolly Stalin along. Stalin, Russia had undergone unimaginable suffering in the war. If you look at the casualty list, I mean, the number of Soviet dead outnumbered anybody else's by miles, which, of course, was largely Stalin's fault because of his style of warfare. Mm. Still, Stalin was an essential ally, so he was buttering him up. But there is something rather sad about that conference. You do see the modern world emerging, the post-war world emerging, poor old Britain slightly being pushed into the side. And Stalin and Roosevelt between them sort of saying, well, we're going to be the two big powers. And, of course, they were right.
Yes, that was probably a rather humiliating experience for Churchill to realize that here he was sitting with these two guys who were running what would be the two future world powers, and that the third world power, Great Britain, would not be a power.
I suspect he must have known that in his heart. The numbers just don't stack up, and he must have known the financial situation and just the sheer size of the other two nations.
The book is A History of Britain in 36 Postage Stamps. Chris West wrote it. He joins us on the program today. And as you go through here, you see all these wonderful stamps. And I realize that in our modern society that our email box is filling up all day long. We're constantly getting deliveries. But I miss the days you describe of the British Post Office where they got as many as a dozen deliveries a day. I would love that.
that was in the Victorian heyday. It came down quite sharply, I think, towards the end of Victoria's reign. But It was before the telephone, that was how you communicated with people. And if you were, you know, you were at work, it was lunchtime, you'd be invited to dinner that evening with the Pooters, you'd write them a letter and stick it in the post, and it would arrive. And they'd get the letter, and oh dear, Mr. Smith isn't coming round for dinner. It was that incredibly essential part of communication in Victoria's day. I'm not sure when the level of deliveries began to back down. I suspect it in Victoria's reign. It probably wasn't usually economical to have quite so many, so I suggest they probably started tailing off long before the telephone came along.
Well, I believe in cities like New York, they used to have that kind of service back in that same period, just all day long. Carriers bringing out the mail, incredibly efficient.
Yeah.
I also felt a real sense of loss and nostalgia reading your book. I'm an avid bicyclist, and you point out that there was a period, maybe just about a decade, where bicyclists had the road.
Absolutely, yes. Really, the late Victorian and most of the Edwardian era, the bicyclist ruled the road. Cars sort of appeared in the 1900s, but they didn't sort of, they'd chug along pretty slowly. And the bicycle was king and queen. It was a wonderful, it was a freedom machine, people called it.
I miss those days, even though I wasn't born. I read
and
that.
They must have been, I agree, they must have been absolutely wonderful, wasn't they? You'd get on your bike and out into this beautiful, unspoiled countryside. Must have been magical.
Really. The book is A History of Britain in 36 Postage Stamps. Chris West wrote it, and he's come over here to the United States. I assume you're on a little book tour?
I'm on a little book tour, yes. I'm talking in New York this evening at the Strand Bookshop.
Oh, wonderful.
Off to Boston, Harvard Bookstore. Then all these talks are great, but I'm actually giving a talk at the Smithsonian for the 11th annual Maynard Sundman Lecture. And he was a great collector, and I think his family now own the Mystic Stamp Company, so that's going to be very special.
I used to get packages from the Mystic Stamp Company when I was a kid.
Yeah, wonderful.
Yeah, I'd look at the back of the comic book, and they'd have a little ad for it, and they'd say, send us a quarter, and we'll send you a collection of stamps, and my mother finally figured it out. She said, Vic, you don't know what approval means, do you? We'll send these to you on approval. I'd get this package of stamps, and I didn't realize I was supposed to send them back or pay for them. But I learned. That's how you learn.
That was fun. I did that as well. I mean, Mystic didn't operate in the UK, but there were other companies that did that, and you just buy these odd packets of stamps. And you used to be able to do that in the Edwardian days as well, because I got a beautiful Edwardian stamp album from a great uncle of mine, and it's full of adverts for exactly this same system. So this wasn't new when you and I were young. This is a tried and tested thing from the Edwardian era.
What a treasure to have that stamp album.
It's lovely. And I brought it with me, so I'm going to be showing it to people.
Wonderful.
At the readings.
Well, I hope you enjoy your tour. We've really enjoyed having you on the program.
It's been a pleasure, Vic. It's really, really nice talking with you.
Our guest has been Chris West. His book, A History of Britain in 36 Postage Stamps. For the Book Nook, I'm Vic McInnes. In this age of burgeoning social media, books remain my favorite form of social media. But if you want to find out what's happening in the Book Nook and you're on Twitter, you can do that. Just go to the Book Nook on Twitter, which is a handle of Book Nook Vic, V-I-C-K, on Twitter, Book Nook Vic, to find out what's coming up in the Book Nook right here on WYSO. The Book Nook is recorded at Soundspace in Yellow Springs and engineered by Chris Hertzler.